So we are going to move on to the next sutta, the next discourse by the Buddha. And this next sutta I'm going to talk about is quite a well-known sutta in the Pali Canon. It's called the Anapanasati Sutta in Pali. It means the discourse on mindfulness of breathing. Ana, quite literally, mindfulness of in and out breathing, quite literally. And it is a well-known sutta. How do we decide whether something is a well-known sutta or has importance or whatever? This is actually a matter that's quite significant, because sometimes you hear, oh, this sutta is important. I tell you this sutta is important, right? Is that just my personal opinion, or are there some objective grounds for deciding this? Generally speaking, if the Buddha talks about something in many different places, to many different audiences, right, different context, slightly different formulation, you can be pretty sure it is an important sutta. And so this is one of those things. Anapanasati, the mindfulness of breathing, is probably the most important of the different ways of meditation the Buddha talks about. And it's quite nice, right? Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, it's so natural. It's not some kind of hocus-pocus, weird kind of, you know, visualization, something weird going on. It's a very natural thing, one of the most natural things in the human body that is always there, and that is easy to focus on. So it's remarkable that this should be the main technique of it's a very kind of unreligious, right? It has very little, it's a very natural thing to do. And of course, all the states that I was talking about earlier on today, I was talking about the psychological, the first person progress on meditation practice, all that comes from watching the breath, right? Watching the breath is what you do, and the result is all these states of mind, one degree of happiness after the other, arising just from watching the very simple fact of being aware of the breath. That's all you have to do. So all of this is just a very, you know, this very natural and straightforward process that is going on. So why is it that I am only talking about this now, if this is the Buddha's main practice of meditation? Why didn't I start to talk about that yesterday evening when I first opened my mouth? Why all this other stuff that I was talking about, if this is the main thing? And the answer to that is that mindfulness of breathing is not something that happens without a foundation. Only when the foundation is in place is really mindfulness of breathing does it become possible. If the foundation isn't there, it just doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, if it doesn't happen naturally, what happens then is that you have to use your willpower, right, to focus on the breath. You have to say, I'm going to focus on the breath, and you grasp hold of the breath. And when you grasp hold of the breath and you use the willpower, what happens is that it becomes very uncomfortable after a while. This is one of the things that makes things uncomfortable, is when we grasp onto things and we hold on to them. It's not natural anymore. It doesn't just happen by itself. This is exactly why I focused yesterday so much on the idea of just sitting back and observing, being aware of things, not being involved. I was saying to notice the sensation when you don't do anything, right? You don't do anything at all. How does it feel? And you find actually feels so good, because you're not being involved in things at all anymore. You're just standing back. So ideally, what you want to do, you want to achieve that feeling of just standing back, just being aware, just watching, getting that first. And when that is established, then you place your attention on the breath after that. And when you do that in the right order, it is so easy. It is so natural. And this is the reason why I'm only bringing this up now, because you want to get the right sequence in these things. And that's also why I said focusing on the body, because it's good to have something to focus on. If you have nothing to focus on, you just sit there. Sometimes you wonder, what am I doing here? What's going on? You lose no idea what's happening anymore. You don't know what you're supposed to be doing. And you kind of just go all over the place, fantasize about this, fantasize about that, in the kind of direction. So a little bit of focus is good. So that's why I suggested focusing on the body to begin with. But now this powerful teaching comes into its right at this particular stage. And I want to show you how the Buddha describes it. Not all the while. I'm not going to show all the various steps of mindfulness of breathing, only part of this, because it is a very profound teaching, and it takes you basically all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. But only those things that are most interesting for a kind of beginning and medium stages of meditation, not the most profound ones. So mindfulness of breathing, straight away you will notice with that word, it's the Pali word is anapanasati. Sati is the word for mindfulness. And mindfulness of breathing, you can see here that the word mindfulness basically means awareness. You're aware of things. That's the basic meaning of mindfulness. So awareness, you could have translated this as awareness instead, which is a more natural word in English. This word mindfulness is a bit more woolly, exactly what it means. It can have many different meanings. So awareness of the breath. So I'll read a little bit out for you, and I'll explain to you, as I always do, what is going on here. And I should maybe also say that there's going to be a Q&A session this evening between, 7 and 9 or something like that? I can't, something like that. Is that right? 8 and 9? Yeah, okay, good. So if you have any questions about these things, it's a good opportunity. You can write it down, and I will try to decipher your handwriting here and then read it out and see if I can reply to those questions. Sometimes if you can write neatly, that's very good. Sometimes you get questions that can't understand anything in what it says there. A couple of words, I can sort of guess what the question might be here and then give you an answer which is kind of completely off the topic. But anyway. Okay, so this is this great sutta on the awareness of the in and out breath there. Monks, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four focuses or four applications of mindfulness. When the four applications of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. When the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill insight and, he says here, true knowledge and deliverance. They fulfill insight and liberation. Right. So this is just the kind of the preamble. This is just the beginning of the sutta, just to give you a sense of the importance of the mindfulness of breathing, right? It shows you everything that is fulfilled as a consequence of just watching the breath. And the very last thing you see here, true knowledge, I think translating it as insight is quite nice. Translating as insight, or real insight, and deliverance as and liberation is the very last factor. That's all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. I'll talk a little bit about that in a second, just to get some idea what these things actually mean and what they refer to. So when you practice this in the proper way, develop and cultivate it, it says here that it fulfills the four, I said, applications of mindfulness. The Pali word for that is satipatthana, which many of you have probably heard of. It is one of the words that is used a lot in Buddhist meditation circles, and lots of famous meditation techniques that are based on satipatthana practice. You may have heard of people like S.N. Goenka. S.N. Goenka is a very, very, very well-known meditation teacher from Burma originally, and he has by far, I think, the most meditation centers around the world of any teacher. And he is basically his teaching is based around the Satipatthana Sutta. And many other teachers, the famous teacher like Mahasi Sayadaw of Burma, another very influential Burmese meditation teacher, more scholar as well, and many others too, they create the systems of meditation around this idea of Satipatthana. There's a sutta which is called the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta, the discourse on the applications of mindfulness, which these teachers base their teachings on, essentially. And sometimes the problem with Satipatthana practice is that it is often very disputed. There's many different ways of doing it, There's many different techniques. Some people say it's all about insight. Other people say it's about samatha. Other people say it's about both, right? So what is it? It's often not very clear what it is. And one easy way of bypassing that whole debate is instead to say, well, if it is that complicated, and we can't really... There are good reasons why we can't agree on this, by the way. Good historical reasons, which have to do with the development of some of these suttas. But I won't get into this now. But an easy way of bypassing all of this is to say that what the Buddha said, if you are going to fulfill the Satipatthana practices, the application of mindfulness, all you have to do is watch the breath, right? You watch the breath, and you fulfill the whole thing that way. You don't really have to worry so much about these different ways that they are described in the Satipatthana Sutta. All you have to do is sit back, watch the breath. And if you are ready, if you have put in the foundation work, and you're ready for that, it will bear precisely those fruits. So you will fulfill that. And what is interesting about this, of course, we talk about Satipatthana. Is it Vipassana? Is it Samatha? Is it both, right? And of course, if mindfulness of breathing, if that fulfills the Satipatthana, then the same question arises for mindfulness of breathing. Is it Vipassana practice? Is it Samatha? Vipassana means insight, clear seeing, discernment, something like that. Samatha means calm. Is it about calm or is it about seeing clearly? What is it about? This is actually quite an interesting question. And maybe I'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of this sutta, if there is time. But basically, I can say now, it really is about both. You cannot distinguish these things, and there is a very good reason why you can't do that. And maybe I'll talk about that afterwards. Insight, vipassana, or clear seeing, vipassana, samatha, karma, these two things always have to go together for very good reasons. And you may have heard Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand, a very famous teacher called Ajahn Chah, maybe the greatest living meditation master in Thailand of the 20th century. Well, at least some would say that. Other people might point to others. Anyway, he had that simile of the knife, right? A knife has to have two sides. You can't just have a one-sided knife. Right? That would be one of those weird Dali paintings. Salvador Dali had his weird paintings. The one-sided knife, something like that. Or maybe that's a Zenko and the one-sided knife. I don't know. But knives usually have two sides. If you're not dealing with Zenko, it has two sides. One side is insight, discernment. The other side is calm. They always have to go together. You can't have a one-sided knife. And this is one of the things that he used. And again, if there's time, I will talk a little bit about that afterwards, because I personally find it quite fascinating why that is the case. And it explains to you a little bit about how meditation actually works. So you have, when you fulfill the Satipatthanas because of that, what you then also fulfill are the seven awakening factors. Seven awakening factors are the seven factors that lead to awakening. Right? And these factors are all about samadhi practice. They're all about the things I was reading out this morning, about the joy, the tranquility, the happiness, the stillness of the mind. All of these things are included in these awakening factors. Right? So it sounds good, right? The factors that lead to awakening. So that sounds like a good deal. Sounds like we're heading in the right direction here. And of course, because these lead to awakening, then it also fulfills the consequence of that, which are then the last factor here, vijja, true knowledge, and then liberation, which is vimutti in the Pali language. And true insight is very interesting in its own right, because this is the liberating insight, seeing things according to its true nature, right? Seeing things according to reality. Sounds good, right? If you don't see things according to reality, what that means, we're going to make all kinds of stupid mistakes. If you think you understand how things work, but you don't, and you act upon your misunderstanding, you can only make mistakes. This is why seeing things according to reality is so important. Because if you see things according to reality, only then can you act in a way that accords with nature, and then you can be wise. if there's only fools who act in contradiction to nature, because it means that you're going to suffer if you do that, because you can't make decisions according to the way things are. If you think the shop is down the street that way, but you don't know where, but you're not aware of that, and you walk that way, well, you're not going to get to the shop, and you're going to get the consequent suffering. It's as simple as that, really. So this is true knowledge, understanding of the world. I'm not going to say anything more for now about that. But the other thing which is interesting here is liberation, vimutti. What does that mean? And it's just the word itself sounds nice, but what it means in Buddhism is the liberation, first from the defilements of the mind. Right? Not having any anger, not having any greed, not having any delusion in the mind. This is the first thing it means. And many people, when they hear that, they think rubbish, that's impossible. You have to have these are qualities of the mind, they always have to be there. It's impossible to get rid of these things entirely. I've heard many people say that before, and I say, okay. And because sometimes you can't really argue with people, that's okay. If you want to believe that, that's fine. But from a Buddhist point of view, it is possible to actually eliminate these things completely. And the reason, I think, why people can't believe that is because it is so ingrained in us. It is so much a part of us. Yes, you can maybe reduce it. Maybe we can get rid of it a little bit. But you can't really get rid of it completely because it's so much part of our personality. We have some greed. We have some upset and anger sometimes. And that's just the way things are. But remember that the Buddhist path here is a very radical path. It's about insight. And because it is about insight, it's about seeing things in an entirely new way. And when you see things in an entirely new way, it has incredible, powerful ramifications for your entire psychology. Your entire psychology changes when you see things in a very different light. From a Buddhist point of view, because our purpose is here to see things in a very new way, it opens up possibilities that normally you think are closed off. And one of those possibilities is to end these defilements completely. Instead of just restraining them, instead of holding them back all the time, which is painful, and after a while you get fed up with that, you can actually eliminate them completely. And this is why, when you sometimes you meet people in the world, right? And you see them and you think, wow, this person is different. I've never seen them angry. I've never seen them greedy, right? It's difficult perhaps sometimes to get close enough to some of these people, but sometimes you are around people for year after year after year, a long time, and you see that the qualities in this person are just different. And you wonder, how can this be possible? If somebody really isn't angry, it will have an impact on how they actually behave, right? They behave differently. And this is one of those beautiful inspirations. If you ever get into the presence of someone who is fully awakened, an arahant, just that presence, just that being aware of somebody that is different is already an extraordinarily powerful experience. I've been around some people who I think, whoa, this is different. It's impossible to know with absolute certainty, but sometimes you have grounds for thinking there's something special, very special going on. Anyway, let's get back to the nitty-gritty of how to get there, because I've already now taken it all the way to the end of the path. But, of course, what is interesting here is how do we get there? This is the teacher, the Buddha, speaking here. So, mindfulness of breathing, tremendous promise, right? Taking us all the way to end of path, liberated from the defilements. I should also say that liberation, the most important thing of all that we are liberated from is suffering. That is the most important thing of all. Buddhism is sometimes called the pessimistic religion because it focuses on suffering. But remember that the flip side of suffering is happiness. If you understand suffering, it means you also understand happiness. And the Buddha's promise is that if you practice this path fully, you will never ever have any more suffering whatsoever. Suffering will be finished one time, once and for all. That's a pretty good deal, isn't it? That absolutely all suffering forever and ever, completely finished. No more problems, just pure happiness and pure bliss for the for forever and ever after. That sounds like a pretty good deal. And of course, it is very powerful. And this is why I think these Buddhist teachings speak to us so powerfully, because they promise us something that everybody is interested in. This is what our life is all about. This is the answer to the meaning of life, if you like. Everything in our life is about a movement towards satisfaction, a movement towards fulfillment, a movement away from problems and suffering. That is what everything in life is about. And here is a teaching that promises to give you exactly that. Okay. So now let us get into how it is done. And how, monks, is this awareness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, a monk, I should add here that monk is just the example here. Anybody else can be put in for a monk, a nun, right? A lay practitioner who is dedicated to the practice. Gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him, ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. So that is the background, the foundation for the mindfulness of breathing here. So the reason why there is a focus here, it says, I mean, here a bhikkhu or here a monk, is because the discourses were usually spoken to monks, but from different contexts it was spoken to different people. I know that, for example, in different traditions, some traditions have he spoke to a monk, other traditions he spoke to the monks and the nuns, and very often there will be a large gathering of people around on these cases. So it doesn't mean that this only applies to monks. But it is a little bit more monastic than it is for lay people. And you will see that straight away in the next line, because it says here, gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut. Right? This is the first thing it says about this exercise of mindfulness of breathing. And what this means is that this type of meditation practice, which can be very profound, take you all the way to awakening, ideally it happens in seclusion. It only really happens fully, perhaps, in seclusion. So you want to be secluded. And this is one of the reasons why you come here to Jhana Grove, right? Because here you are more secluded than in your ordinary life. You get into the forest, away from the city, away from all those disturbances, and you have a chance to practice this meditation properly. In the suttas, they have this idea of seclusion. It's called viveka in the Buddhist language. It means you are separated from something. And according to Buddhism, you, first of all, you separate in body. So it's called kaya viveka. So you that means that you are physically separated. That's why it says you're living in a hut by yourself. You are physically separated. And then when you are physically separated, that leads to mental separation, which is citta viveka. So one thing follows after. You have to be bodily, physically separated first before you get mental separation. So what does mental separation mean? I don't know what that feels to you. If you feel mental separation to you, is it scary or is it sound nice? It's kind of ambivalent, but I'm not really sure about whether it's scary or whether it's nice, mental separation. But actually, if you understand what it means, it actually is very nice. Because mental separation really here refers to separation from the defilements. Right? So what that means, again, that may also sound a bit abstract, but imagine yourself on a day when you are very at ease, you have a lot of time for other people, you don't have any big desires, you feel very peaceful, right? And you feel very relaxed, and you have a sense of compassion and kindness for the people around you, all coming quite naturally from you. What does that feel like? It feels good, right? And that is what is meant by a lack of defilements. Buddhism tends to phrase these things in a kind of negative terminology, but actually it means the opposite. So when you have no defilements, it feels incredibly nice. It feels like you are, this is what freedom is, the first stage of freedom in Buddhism. It's called vimokkha in the Buddhist Pali language. And it's the first kind of liberation. You feel, wow, how wonderful, I'm liberated from all these tyrants in my mind. And now I feel peaceful. Now I feel at ease. I feel really, really good about it. I have clarity. I can see things clearly. You know, you feel a sense of natural sense of kindness and compassion for the world and the people around you. So this is what citta viveka, separation, mental separation means. You're separated from these defilements. There's no attachments there, no desires, no anger, none of these obstructions in the mind that clouds your ability to attain deep meditation, and clouds your ability to see things in a clear way. So why is it that this separation and seclusion is so important? And it's probably good to maybe think about that just a tiny little bit. And the first reason is obviously that if you are in the city life, if you are at home with your family or whatever, it is often very disturbing, right? If you have a family, if you have small children, they're crying and asking for your attention, you have all the cars and all the advertisement that the TV is on, right? There's a constant bombardment of sensual impressions coming into you all the time. That's the obvious, very obvious that is good to get away from that. But there are also deeper reasons why you want to get into the forest. Another reason is that when you are in the world, not only are you bombarded in the senses all the time, but that bombardment has an effect on your mind. Right? If you're bombarded with all the advertisements, you know, scantily clad young people, you know, and all of these things everywhere, all the way around you, it affects you, and it gives rise to defilements. And because it gives rise to defilements, it's very hard to find that citta viveka, the seclusion of the mind in the city. That's why you move into the forest. There's something about the forest that does not give rise to those defilements in the same way. The forest has a kind of peaceful feel. I'm sure you notice that when you come here to Jhana Grove, how the bushland around here makes you peaceful. It doesn't really excite you. It may be beautiful, but it's not beautiful in the same way as, you know, the sensual impingements that you have in the city, for example. So this is these are some of the reasons why it is very, very useful to withdraw and get away from the city. It's also good to get away from your ordinary habitual environment, right? Where you have your family, your house, and all these kind of things. Because all of these things, they remind you all the time, I own this, this is my stuff, right? And when this reminds of this all the time, it makes you desires and planning and things arise in your mind as a consequence. So getting away from all that is actually a very good thing. So this is why we have monasticism, right? This is one of the reasons we have monasticism, that people can withdraw into the forest and practice on their own. This is why we have meditation centers. Meditation centers are like a halfway house. You're not really a full monastic, but you're kind of heading in that direction, right? Is that right? You feel like you're heading in that way? You're becoming kind of half monastic when you come here. It's true in a sense, isn't it? Because you're not talking very much, you're kind of living away from everybody else, you're kind of getting in that direction. So this is this helps you to cultivate those things. And you may wonder, perhaps these reasons I've given you, perhaps they don't sound all that convincing. Yeah, you can practice at home and all that kind of stuff. But just to give you some idea of how important this is, there is a sutta called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is the sutta on the last days of the Buddha's life. Right? The Buddha is wandering towards the place where he's going to die, he's going to pass away, and it will be the end of the Buddha. And obviously, this is a time the Buddha knows that he's coming to an end. He knows that the teachings I'm giving now, this is my legacy, these are the last teachings I will be giving to the monks and the nuns, and also to the lay people. Who's kind of laying down the groundwork, the things that are really important that the monks should remember after his passing away. And one of these teachings are about the seven factors that will ensure the longevity of Buddhism in the future. Right? Quite interesting. What are the seven factors that will ensure, maximize the longevity of Buddhism in the future? And some of those things are fairly obvious. There are things like the Sangha, the monastic order, working in harmony, right? Not arguing and disputing with each other, the kind of thing that you would expect. But one of those seven factors, and this is always, I found it astonishing when I read that. One of those seven factors is that the Buddhism the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, would thrive and survive in the world as long as the monastic order enjoys forest lodgings. As long as they enjoy secluded lodgings in the forest, the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, would flourish. And from what I've been saying, you can probably start to appreciate that. And the reason is because you need to withdraw from all of that to be able to calm your mind down enough to be able to do mindfulness and breathing. This is what the sutta is about, right? Mindfulness and breathing. To be able to do that fully, you actually have to withdraw from the world. And only then is it really possible to have those insights and those profound meditations that otherwise you wouldn't be getting. And only by having those deep insights is Buddhism safeguarded for the future. Because it is those insights you are recreating the understanding of the Buddha. And as long as we keep on recreating the understanding of the Buddha in the world, so long will the Buddha's teachings survive. The moment we don't recreate those things and they kind of disappear out the window, then of course Buddha is really dead. It becomes a letter, it becomes a book knowledge that doesn't really exist in the heart of people anymore. And once it is dead in that way, you don't have the inspiration of seeing people who are awakened and all these things. So that's how important it is in Buddhism, the idea of seclusion. So I recommend you, if you have the chance, I recommend you to come here once a year, twice a year, whatever. Do a retreat, enjoy yourself, see how things go from last year. One of the great ways of knowing whether your general practice as a Buddhist actually is working here is to see if every year your meditation is a little bit better, right? You've gone up one notch from last year. Your mindfulness is a bit more sharp. Your ability to stay with the breath is a bit better. You feel a bit more kind-hearted, or you know, at least you don't sleep all day, right? And whatever it is, you feel that you have moved up a little bit compared to what you did the year before. It doesn't matter what it is, as long as you're heading in the right direction. So this is something I recommend you. Of course, if you want to become monastic, I can recommend that too, right? Not that that's a great thing as well. So if you kind of feel that that is a nice thing to do, it is something that I would always recommend people. But it has to come quite naturally. You have to feel that it is for you. You shouldn't pressure yourself into these kind of things. Anyway, so that is about seclusion. So you go to any of these secluded places, the root of a tree, an empty hut, to the forest, and then you sit down. Right? So this is one of those things, you sit down. So real meditation, which is going to be profound, happens in the sitting posture, usually. That is where normally you can get the most profound meditation experiences. Because the body is calm, the body is relaxed. It's relatively easy to focus on the breath. It's not very hard to focus on the breath if you are walking. So you do it in the sitting posture. And then it says, once you do that, you sit down. It says, having folded your legs crosswise and setting the body erect. So the idea here is that it doesn't actually mean that you necessarily have to sit cross-legged, but that was the custom in those days. People usually at that time would sit on the floor, right? You were born on the sitting on the floor. You spent your whole life sitting on the floor. So it was easy for people to sit on the floor. These days, people sit on chairs. So because we sit on chairs, I usually recommend people to sit on chairs unless you are really comfortable on the floor. So this has more to do with custom than it has to do with necessity. And you set your body erect, right? So the idea here is that if you are fairly straight in the back, it sits fairly straight, your clarity of mind tends to be greater. But again, it's a matter of time and place. You have to know the right time, and this is why I sometimes recommend people just to lean back and relax first of all. And then when mindfulness starts to arise, it's almost natural that you straighten up the body. It feels natural, it feels automatic, and then it is the right time to do that. If you try to force yourself to sit straight when you are not ready for it, it will just lead to discomfort and it won't work. So all of these things are about the right time and right place, knowing what it works for you. So feel, right? What does it feel like? Does it feel like a stress position, like one of those torture positions that they talk about? If it feels like a torture position, please don't do it. If it feels nice and comfortable, that is the right time. Okay? Buddhism is not about torture. If you want to be tortured, I will recommend you some other religions that are really good for that, but not Buddhism. So try, remember that. If you always remember the idea of being relaxed, being at ease, then you have such a good guidance for whether you're doing the right thing or not. And then it says, setting the body erect, and then we have established mindfulness in front of oneself. So this is the next one here, right? So this, remember, all of these things come before you are starting to watch the breath. This is the background. This is the foundation. You're still just pouring the concrete, right? Before you can start to erect the house on that foundation. So you have to have mindfulness first. Mindfulness has to be there first. This is what I was talking about this morning as well, and yesterday. Only when mindfulness is present, is at least some degree, is it possible or is it advisable to watch the breath? So what does it mean that mindfulness has to be established? What exactly does that mean? And what it means, it is something you have to experiment and find out to some extent yourself. But what it means is that you are sitting here, and you're feeling relaxed, you're feeling at ease, and you have a degree of presence of mind. You feel that your mind is here and now, in this room. It's not float going all over the place, thinking about the past, thinking about the future, fantasizing about your holiday to India or whatever it is. But you are here, right, in this moment, at this time. That is what it means. And you have a sense of clarity about this. It's not a kind of a dull awareness or a very hyperactive awareness. It's a clear, calm awareness of the present moment. That's essentially what this word sati, mindfulness, means. Parimukkang, in front of you, in the present, right here. And so how do we do that? How do we establish that mindfulness? And this is why I'm saying, don't go to the breath too early. The vast majority of people go to the breath too quickly. Please don't do that. It will be painful for you. You have to use force to hold the breath, and that will feel unnatural. It will feel painful. So give rise to the mindfulness first of all. And this is what all the sitting back, allowing things to settle down, allowing the tiredness to disappear, and just waiting to mindfulness to be established by itself. Focusing on the body, feeling the sense of ease, enjoying the place, giving rise to beautiful perception in the mind, where you feel a sense of metta and kindness for the people around you, when you have a sense of, wow, what a wonderful thing it is to be here. And then mindfulness comes. And when mindfulness comes, then it is the time to watch the breath. And then there's also all the other things I was talking about this morning. Remember that mindfulness is not something that you can just create out of nothing. Mindfulness arises. If it's going to arise naturally, it arises because of causes and conditions. And those causes and conditions I was talking about this morning is always your character. What are your qualities as a person? Are they generally good qualities? Are they qualities of kindness, of compassion, of understanding? Or do you find that sometimes you get upset too quickly, or you have too many desires or whatever it is? Now, this is where you find out what your character is like. And the more pure your character is, the more good-hearted, good-natured you are, the more pure-hearted you are as a person, the more mindfulness you will have. So this shows you exactly what you have to do. If you have any doubts, if your mindfulness isn't clear, now you know exactly what you have to do. And I will talk more in detail about this idea of how to develop that sila, that thing we call character or virtue in Buddhism. I'll talk more about that tomorrow, because it is a very fundamental part of the training in the Buddhist practice. And some of this you can also do as part of the meditation practice. So remember, mindfulness first, then mindfulness of breathing, right? After all, it's called mindfulness of breathing. If you haven't got mindfulness already, how are you going to do mindfulness of breathing? It's impossible. Can't do it. So you have to establish that mindfulness first. Okay. So then it says, having established that when all of these things are in place, right? Then it says here, ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Now, fortunately, I happen to know the Pali language a little bit. So here he says, ever mindful. I don't think that's the correct translation. I think it should be just mindful. Just mindful, you breathe in. just mindful, you breathe out. Every mindful has the idea that you're always mindful. I don't think that happens yet at this stage, but just mindful means, and this ties in with what I was saying this morning, is that all you have to do is to be mindful and allow the breath to be there. And then things develop as an automatic process as a consequence of that awareness. You're just aware and the development happens. There's nothing you have to do. Right? As I was saying this morning, this is not to be done through intention. May joy arise in me. This happens as a natural consequence of non-remorse. Right? If you have no remorse, joy will arise. This is nature. And in exactly the same way here, we don't apply any will, any intention. You don't have to have an intention in this place. You don't have to will this into being. In fact, the will just gets in the way here. All you have to be is mindful. That's why it is just mindful rather than anything else in addition to mindfulness. This is not to be done by not Chaitanya Karaniya. This is not to be done by the will. It means the will gets in the way. The will is a problem. Take the will out of the equation. Allow things to happen. And then mindfulness of breathing happens by itself. So easy, right? Very easy. Sit back. Enjoy. Have a good time. Whoa. This is so, it's beautiful. And I, you know, this is why these teachings are so lovely. And this is why you have to understand the details. If you don't understand the details, you think, yeah, okay, ever mindful, breathe in. Okay, next passage, breathing in long. You don't really get it. But once you have a feeling for these things, you start to see how it all interacts with each other. It actually gets very exciting because it is very profound and very meaningful. Almost every word has a meaning in this, these suttas. One of the things that the Buddha says about his teaching, remember the Buddha is the teacher, right, with capital T, and one of the things it says about it is that it is a sa'atta, savyanjana, which means it has the right meaning and the right phrasing. When the Buddha phrases teaching, it is very specific, it is not random. He puts a lot of attention to phrasing it in just the right way. No words are superfluous, no words are omitted. Exactly what we need is there. And I'm not going to go into, I was going to branch off into some other thing. I don't want to branch off too much because we will be here for a long time if we do that. And there will be too much information, you get information overload, and then you're even more confused when you leave than when you came in, which would be no good, right? And I would have failed as a teacher if I did that. So I'm going to try to avoid the information overload. It's difficult sometimes because in a group where so many people here, there are people at all different stages. I know some of you know heaps and heaps about Buddhism, maybe more than I do. So then that's when you feel a bit, you have to teach those as well. And there are some who are beginners, so it makes it difficult. So hopefully everybody gets a little bit out of this. But please, if you have questions again, you can ask those this evening. So now we get to the real thing. And I only have a few minutes to do the real thing, the actual meditation exercise. So far, I've been setting up all the background stuff. So what do you think about that? Is that bad? Is that because I'm a bad teacher? I kind of spend so much time with all the background stuff and say only so much about the actual meditation? Have I failed again as a teacher? Should you boo at this stage and say, you can't please? What should we do at this stage? And of course, the point is, and this is exactly the point I've been making just before, is that it is the establishing of all these things which is the most important part. Because once all of these things are established, then these other things happen by themselves. They're automatic. This is the whole idea about not having to use your will, right? Not having to use your volition, your choice, your intention. You can just sit back. That's why I spend so much time on these surrounding factors, because they are what makes the meditation possible. So now we can actually go through the meditation. It's also very exciting, of course, but we can do it a little bit more quickly. So this is how mindfulness of breathing, the actual breathing exercise, is described in the suttas. Breathing in long, he understands, I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he understands, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands, I breathe in short. And breathing out short, he understands, I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, Asha, without experiencing the whole body of the breath. He trains thus, Asha, breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, Asha, breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So, first one, right? Breathing in long, he understands. I breathe in long, or she understands. He is always the default gender, just like it tends to be in English, but it includes everybody. Breathing in long, he understands. I breathe in long. So what does that mean? All it means is that you are aware of your breath. You know whether it's a long breath or you know whether it's a short breath. You know if it's a medium breath. You have awareness of what's going on. That's all it means. It does not mean that you are trying to have a long breath. For goodness sake, don't force your breath to be long or short or whatever. Sometimes you hear that, but really, there's nothing in the suttas to support the idea that you should force your breath to be in a certain way. Your job is to be passive. This is one of those things again. Passive, just aware, not doing anything in particular. So this just shows you that you have enough awareness to know whether your breath is long or short. Right? It doesn't take that much awareness, but it takes a little bit of awareness. If your mind is going all over the place, you won't even be aware of that. But if you have a relative degree of mindfulness, you will be able to know whether your breath is short, long, medium, super long, super short, and anything in between. So just a basic awareness of the breath. And then the second one, breathing out, is the same thing. So every breath you have awareness. And then you have the breathing in short, right? Breathing out short, I experience the breath. I understand. You understand what is happening here. So again, there is just the in-breathing and the out-breathing is just enough awareness to be able to know that these things are there. It's very simple. And the idea here is just that to know, you have to know something about the breath. And the length of the breath is perhaps the most natural thing to be aware of, right? Also, one question that often comes up in this particular context is, where should I know the breath? And there's all these books written about where you should be aware of the breath. Should it be on the nose? Should it be in the abdomen? Should it be on the lip, on the upper surface of the lip? Should it be in one nostril or both? Usually only one, because it usually breathes only through one nostril, apparently. All of these things, right? And actually, it doesn't really say in the suttas anyway. It just says parimukkang. Parimukkang has this amorphous quality, which means like in front of you, you are established. It just means in the present moment, really. So all you have to do, and this is what Ajahn Brahm teaches, and I think Ajahn Brahm is right about this. It is just the awareness of whether the breath is long or short, without any specific point on the body, right? When you sit down and meditate and you start to know whether your breath is long or short, you know that. It doesn't have to be related to any particular part of the body. It's just an awareness of the breath. You may find that when you become very refined in a meditation practice, it will actually relate to a certain part of the body. But the best thing is not to pin it down too much. Because if you pin it down too much, often what you find is that the will creeps in. The will wants to hold on to that particular point, and because you hold on to that particular point, you find you get tension, you find you can't relax, you get what they call a samadhi headache. This is famous in places where they practice the samadhi too hard, and you get this tension in the head as a consequence of focusing too hard. So please don't get the samadhi headache, because that is bad news. And sometimes when you get those samadhi headaches, you can't get rid of them anymore because you get so used to using force in a meditation practice, you don't know how to relax it anymore. So please don't get into that. If you get things get too tense, slack off. Don't try so hard. Just relax in the present moment or whatever. Don't allow that tension to build up. Okay, so that is the breathing in long, breathing in short. There's a sequence there because usually as you calm down, the breath often gets shorter. Initially, when you calm down, it gets longer, and then later on, it becomes shorter, depending on how the degree of your calmness. Then, the next one is experiencing the whole body of the breath, right? Already, if you can just experience the long breath and the short breath, you're doing very well. Because it may, if you can do it naturally and at ease, you're already doing very well. But now, from here on, we're starting the training, which is called the mindfulness of breathing. So far, it has been a natural consequence of mindfulness that you are aware of the breath, but now you train. So now you're looking for a certain progression to happen. So while, as you stay with the breath, when you do that, you find your thinking subsides even more, and your ability to see what is going on expands. And because that expands, you become aware of more of that breath, right? The whole body of the breath you are aware of. The whole thing, as it moves in and moves out, you don't really miss any part of that breath. Sometimes you can imagine that as the beginning, the middle, and the end of the breath, but really you are with the whole experience, whatever that is. This also is sometimes argued what exactly this means. It's called, the Pali is the Sabbakaya Patisangvedi, and some of these terms can be a little bit ambiguous. But again, I think personally, I think the natural explanation is precisely that you are aware of the whole breath at this stage. So you're aware of the whole breath. Your mindfulness is expanding, right? You're becoming more into the present moment. The mind isn't going anywhere anymore so much, into the future, the past, into fantasy land, whatever it is, but more and more powerfully into the present moment. And it's already at this stage, it starts to become very nice, right? If you are aware of the whole breath, but any kind of interruption, nothing is really interrupting you. It means you're very centered inside of yourself. The world outside is already fading away to a very large extent, already at this stage, a very early stage in the meditation practice. So already this is actually a fairly advanced stage of meditation already. It is not that many people for whom this happens very naturally. And then, once you have that awareness of the whole breath, the last one here is what they call the tranquilizing the bodily formation. Right? The bodily formation here is just another name for the breath. Again, you have to know these discourses to understand what some of this terminology means. So you're tranquilizing the breath, right? And that's how you're training. Remember, there's no will required here. You are not really tranquilizing. The tranquilization is happening by itself. All you have to do is to stay there, enjoy what you're doing, right? And it's already now it's becoming a little bit enjoyable. You're really finding this is becoming quite nice. So because it is quite nice, it is relatively easy to just continue on that, staying with the breath. And as you continue with that, it starts to calm down. It tranquilizes. It becomes more and more refined. And everything becomes more and more beautiful as you do that. So this is the first stage of the Anapanasati Sutta. It's divided into four stages, and this is the first one. It has to do very directly with the breath itself, how we allow the breath to calm down, how our mindfulness expands to encompass the whole breath. Now, from here, we move on to the second aspect, the second tetrad. It's called four tetrad. The four tetrad, 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. And the second tetrad, now we're moving into the area of feeling. This is equivalent to the contemplation of feeling in the Satipatthana Sutta. So what is happening here is that when the mind is becoming more and more the breath is becoming more and more refined, more and more peaceful, the mindfulness is expanding, there comes a point when piti, happiness, joy, starts to arise in the mind. Everything becomes so peaceful, so nice, so beautiful, that a natural joy starts to arise in the mind. I'm sure you all know what joy means, right? Sometimes, some days you just feel joyful to be alive and you kind of skip around and you feel a sense of gladness in your heart. It's a bit similar to that. There's a natural joy that arises. This feeling of just being, everything is wonderful, everything is beautiful. And so this is the second aspect. I'll just read it out for you first of all, and I'll just discuss these four elements very briefly before we call it a session. So he trains, thus I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. This is piti in Pali. He trains, thus I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. He trains, thus I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. He trains, thus I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. He trains thus, Asha, breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains thus, Asha, breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. So when the breath calms down, when the breath becomes very peaceful, joy starts to arise. You feel tingling sensations in the body. You feel the mind is getting light and beautiful. And kind of everything becomes very nice at this point. Right? And this happens again. Remember, all of these things happen as a natural consequence. So when you come to this stage, sometimes you get a bit excited, right? Wow, this is really great. You know, if I had known that meditation could do this to me, I would have started many lifetimes ago, because this is great stuff. And why? How come I haven't gotten any further until now? It means that last lifetime I was a bit lazy. Let me get into it now at least. So you get excited, you get a bit excited, and then you think, oops, lost it all, right? You got excited, you start to think about it, and you kind of go back to square one again. And this happens sometimes, because excitement can happen when you see amazing things happening in this practice. Sometimes this is still, you can still deal with this, but as you go further, excitement can is even more likely to take over. So you start to experience a rapture. You are getting more used to this, you don't get so excited, so you allow the rapture to calm down, and then you get into what is called pleasure here. Pleasure is just the development of that rapture. It's a more peaceful version of the rapture that you had before. Right? So it's just happiness upon happiness. And then, when you have happiness upon happiness, the next thing is that you're experiencing the mental formation. This is why I don't like this translation, because when you come to something like that, you see this beautiful sutta, experiencing rapture, pleasure, and then you experience the mental formation, and you wonder, what on earth does that mean? How does that fit into with pleasure and happiness? Now, it kind of turns you off when you hear that kind of thing. But the mental formation is just basically the experiencing of the mind itself. The movement of the mind, the content of the mind, the perception and feelings that you have, but also it can mean the actual intention or the movement of the mind at that particular point. So you experience the mind, the nature of the mind is what you're experiencing. Yeah? And because you're experiencing the nature of the mind, the next one is to tranquilize that. At this point, you're experiencing rapture, you're experiencing happiness, you're really enjoying yourself, right? But you want to take it further still. Maybe you feel that there's no point in going any further, I've gone far enough, this is great enough. But no, the Buddha says there is more, even more things to be experienced, even more powerful. And you think, okay, I'll just follow along, right? And what you're doing now is to calm these things down. The mind still is not 100% still. There's still some movement there. There's still the breath going on in the background, right? There's still things happening. You want to calm all that down. So the mind becomes even more peaceful, even more still. And as you do that, even more powerful states of happiness arise as a consequence. The next stage on this path, which I haven't included in this particular reading here today, is experiencing the mind. And this is what happens when you calm down the pleasure that you have with the breath. There comes a point when the breath pretty much disappears into the background, and you start to experience in the mind itself. And this is where you start to get things like these powerful lights, like seeing the sun in your meditation practice, except it isn't the sun, right? You think it's the sun, but it isn't the sun. And it's just this incredibly powerful light, bright light, that you start to see as a consequence of the purity of the mind. It was an amazing story. I remember this. She was from Vietnam originally. This lady, she must have been a very pure-hearted woman. And she told me that she had been to this temple. I think it was in Melbourne or something, Vietnamese temple in Melbourne. And they had a shrine outside the temple. And at this shrine, they had a statue of Kuan Yin, right? You know, the goddess of mercy, the Chinese Buddhists, that they have in Chinese Buddhism. And she said when she was so attracted to this statue, so she went there and she was going to bow down to this statue. But as she was bowing down, she saw the sun, right? And she said, oh, I saw the sun as I was bowing down. And I put my hands in front of my eyes because it was so bright. But this, even though I put my hands in front of my eyes, the sun was still there. What was going on? Right? And this is kind of the experience you can have if you have a very, very pure heart and you have a very kind of powerful state of like confidence in what you're bowing down to, or confidence in the teaching, or confidence in your meditation object. These are the kind of things that can happen here. And at this point, it really becomes wow, right? At this point, it is life-transforming, the kind of experiences you're happening here, that are happening, because it is just so different from what you normally experience in life. So that is some of the things that you have to look forward to when you practice mindfulness of breathing. All you have to do is watch your breath, and you experience bliss that you have never experienced before, if you practice this path in the right way. Please don't expect these things to happen. Please don't ever expect anything in your meditation. Enjoy what you have now. If you enjoy what you have now, and you're just happy with what you have, and you're content with what you have, that is always the fastest way to move forward on this path. But it's wonderful to know what is there. I've given you a lot of information about how to get there, but also some ideas about what actually is available as you practice this path. Okay, so that is all for now. There will be some interviews shortly, and this evening there will be a Q&A session at 8 o'clock. Is it a guided meditation at 7:30? Yes? Okay, good. I can't remember the time schedule anymore, so I'll see you back here at 7:30 this evening.